content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the November 2022 edition of Education Today. We'll get started with an article from U.S. News titled, Government Awarding $1 Billion to Schools for Electric Buses. Nearly 400 school districts across the country are receiving grants totaling about $1 billion to purchase 2,500 clean school buses under a new federal program. Nearly 400 school districts spanning all 50 states and Washington, D.C., along with several tribes and U.S. territories, are receiving roughly $1 billion in grants to purchase about 2,500 clean school buses under a new federal program. The Biden administration is making the grants available as part of a wider effort to accelerate the transition to zero-emission vehicles and reduce air pollution near schools and communities. Vice President Kamala Harris and Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Michael Regan announced the grant awards Wednesday in Seattle. The new, mostly electric school buses will reduce greenhouse gas emissions, save money, and better protect children's health, they said. As many as 25 million children ride yellow school buses each school day, and they will have a healthier future with a cleaner fleet, Harris said. We are witnessing around our country and around the world the effects of extreme climate, she said. What we're announcing today is a step forward in our nation's commitment to reduce greenhouse gases, to invest in our economy, to invest in building the skills of America's workforce, all with the goal of not only saving our children, but for them, saving our planet. Only about 1% of the nation's 480,000 school buses were electric as of last year, but the push to abandon traditional diesel buses has gained momentum in recent years. Money for the new purchases is available under the Federal Clean School Bus Program, which includes $5 billion from the bipartisan infrastructure law President Joe Biden signed last year. The Clean Bus Program is accelerating our nation's transition to electric and low-emission school buses while ensuring a brighter, healthier future for our children, Regan said. The EPA initially made $500 million available for clean buses in May, but increased that to $965 million last month, responding to what officials called overwhelming demand for electric buses. An additional $1 billion is set to be awarded in the budget year that began October 1st. The EPA said it received about 2,000 applications requesting nearly $4 billion for more than 12,000 buses, mostly electric. Some 389 applications worth $913 million were accepted to support purchase of 2,463 buses, 95% of which will be electric, the EPA said. The remaining buses will run on compressed natural gas or propane. School districts identified as priority areas serving low-income, rural, or tribal students make up 99% of the projects that were selected, the White House said. More applications are under review, and the EPA plans to select more winners to reach the full $965 million in coming weeks. Districts set to receive money range from Wrangell, Alaska to Anniston, Alabama, and Teton County, Wyoming to Wirt County, West Virginia. Besides the District of Columbia, big cities that won grants for clean school buses include New York, Dallas, Houston, Atlanta, and Los Angeles. White House advisor Mitch Landrieu said he expects many buses to be delivered by the start of the next school year, with the remainder likely to be in service by the end of 2023. The $1 billion being spent this year, along with an additional $4 billion expected over the next 4 years, should supercharge a domestic manufacturing boom for electric school buses, said Landrieu, a former New Orleans mayor tapped by Biden to oversee spending in the massive infrastructure law. These buses will be made in America. Real jobs with real wages, Landrieu said in an interview. We are going to ramp up manufacturing in this country. Environmental and public health groups hailed the announcement, which comes after years of advocacy to replace diesel-powered buses with cleaner alternatives. It doesn't make sense to send our kids to school on buses that create brain-harming, lung-harming, cancer-causing, climate-harming pollution, said Molly Roch, public health policy director for Moms Clean Air Force, an environmental group. Our kids, our bus drivers, and our communities deserve better. The next article comes from Education Week, and it's titled, Will Elon Musk's Takeover of Twitter Start an Educator Exodus? By Allison Klein, posted November 10, 2022. U.S. Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona, Los Angeles Superintendent Alberto Carvalho, and Randy Weingarten, the president of the American Federation of Teachers, may seem like big celebrities in the world of K-12 education. But none of them has as many Twitter followers as Nicholas Ferroni. Ferroni, a former soap opera actor once named People magazine's sexiest teacher alive, uses the social media platform and his 125,500 followers to promote LGBTQ community rights, culturally responsive teaching, measures to make educators' jobs more manageable, and other priorities. But now, Ferroni, who teaches social studies in Union, New Jersey, is wondering if it's time to move on from Twitter. Late last month, Elon Musk, the billionaire entrepreneur, took over Twitter, promising big changes he contends will advance free speech. Critics, though, worry Musk's policies will instead allow the hate and dangerous misinformation Twitter management previously sought to squelch to go unchecked. For now, Ferroni, like many teachers who have found a community on Twitter, is in watch-and-wait mode. If it gets to a point where people are brutally attacking and demoralizing and lying about educators in general, that's something I won't be able to stomach, he said. In the days since October 27th, when Musk officially took over the platform, many educators have been similarly soul-searching. Twitter has offered teachers in school and district leaders a corner of the internet to interact with their communities, swap lesson ideas, find out what's going on in schools around the country, air their frustrations with the profession, and get inspired. Some educators, including Ferroni, have also used the platform as a way to showcase their side hustles as authors, speakers, and consultants. I use Twitter to make my job easier, to share with others, to grow my network, and to learn, said Christina Holzweiss, the education technology enrichment specialist at Syosset High School on New York's Long Island, who has nearly 20,000 followers. Right now, she's also using the social media platform in part to promote the two children's books she's authored and has no immediate plans to leave. So far, she hasn't seen big changes in her Twitter feed, which she chalks up to how easy it is to curate content on the platform. Still, she points out that some parts of it can be cesspools, which is true of all social media. You have to know that people are going to voice their opinions, whatever the format is. The free speech debate has serious real-world implications. For now, Ferroni is using the potential transformation of Twitter as an opportunity to probe some of his favorite questions with his students. He said those include, is there a problem with allowing complete and open and unfiltered free speech? What is free speech? What is hate speech? His classes have plenty of fodder for those discussions. The most prominent example of how possible changes to Twitter may have a big impact. After the 2020 election, President Donald Trump and many of his allies in the Republican Party tweeted that there was widespread voter fraud, despite an overwhelming lack of evidence that this was the case. Twitter fact-checked Trump's assertions. Some applauded the move, but Trump and his allies decried it as infringing on the president's right to free speech, and critics of Trump said the move was too little, too late. Ultimately, the former president was banned from the platform after the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, which sought to block Congress from certifying President Joe Biden's victory. Even as Trump supporters stormed the building, the former president continued to tweet out lies about the election results, fueling violence and putting lawmakers' and police officers' lives in danger. Musk has said he would allow Trump, who has started his own platform, Truth Social, to rejoin Twitter. Though he originally appeared to embrace a no-restrictions approach to content on the platform, Musk recently announced that he would form a content moderation panel with widely diverse views. A spokesman for Twitter did not respond to a request for comment on Musk's plans. Republican lawmakers who are big allies of Trump, including Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee and Representatives Lauren Boebert of Colorado and Jim Jordan of Ohio, have cheered Musk's acquisition of the platform, while Democrats expressed serious concerns. Almost immediately after taking over the company, Musk fired Twitter's top executives, dissolved its board, and laid off about half the staff, stoking fears that there would be far fewer people advocating and doing the daily work of moderating the platform. There was a measurable, immediate spike in hate speech on Twitter in the hours after Musk took the reins of the company, according to an analysis by researchers at Montclair State University. In the week prior to Musk assuming control, specific racial slurs and threatening language were used an average of 84 times an hour, or a little more than 1,000 times in a 12-hour period, the researchers found. However, in the 12 hours just after Musk assumed control of the platform, that number more than quadrupled to 4,778 times. Those changes were enough to send Nate Bowling heading for the virtual exit door. If you are a black person online who has opinions, then bile rolls into your mentions on a pretty regular basis. Bowling, who several years ago left his job as a social studies teacher in Tacoma, Washington, where he was named Teacher of the Year, to work at an embassy school in the United Arab Emirates, said in a phone interview, "After the 2016 election, I was getting racially harassed and attacked and called the N-word on a weekly basis," Bowling said. "Most of the Twitter accounts that harassed him are no longer active because Twitter suspended them," he added. But Bowling doesn't believe the platform under Musk would do the same. He's switching to Mastodon, a social media platform with a lower profile, but also with what Bowling sees as a more civil discourse. He knows the change will have consequences for his ability to reach a larger audience to share his views on social justice and education. Bowling's big Twitter presence appears to have driven listeners to his podcast, Nerd Farmer, and helped him secure speaking engagements, including talking to real estate agents about how segregated neighborhoods lead to segregated schools. He's giving that up, as well as the nearly 24,000 followers he's accumulated over more than a decade on the platform. But he doesn't think he has a choice. The idea that in the name of some contorted version of free speech we're potentially going to allow bigots and people who have fomented political violence a place in the common sphere, Bowling said, I just can't co-sign it. Changes to verification could create headaches for schools. Musk has also proposed a key change to the verification process, in which Twitter investigates a particular account to determine if the person behind it is who they say they are. This is particularly important for distinguishing a Twitter account of a real official, like a school superintendent or principal, from an imposter. Facebook, Instagram, and other platforms use a similar process. On Twitter, accounts that are verified carry a blue check mark. Becoming verified can be a long and opaque process. Dozens of school districts have reportedly tried to get verification and been rejected. Musk has said he will allow anyone who pays Twitter $8 a month to become verified and will charge already verified users the same amount to keep their status. It remains to be seen if that policy would allow, for instance, a high schooler to create an account in their principal's name, pay $8, and then tweet that school is closed for the week. That could add to the confusion already surrounding imposter accounts. For families, it's vital to know whether posts about their children's schools are the real deal, said Melissa Braham, the associate director of the National School Public Relations Association, in an email. NSPRA and other education groups have been pushing Twitter and other platforms to create a separate verification process for schools and districts. The contacts at Twitter who are working with the education organizations say they are still committed to that conversation, Braham wrote. But of course, many details are still emerging, she added. One big question heavy Twitter users in the K-12 world are now asking themselves. If not Twitter, where do we go? Susie Brooks, the director of instructional technology for the Mashpee Public Schools on Cape Cod in Massachusetts, recalled that when she first joined the platform, I met so many people, and then when you'd go to larger conferences, it would be like, oh my gosh, I know you on Twitter, said Brooks during an online panel discussion hosted by Thrive in EDU, an education consulting organization. That was always exciting. The Thrive panel discussed Mastodon, TikTok, Discord, Facebook, and other platforms, including some startups. I'm staying, Brooks said. I feel like I'm not there to serve Twitter, it's there to serve me. I know that there are still things in the periphery that I don't agree with, whether it's political or pornography, but Twitter is not where I'm going to put my big effort into any more for connecting and improving my practice. The next article comes from the New York Times, and it's titled, Pranks, Parties, and Politics, Ron DeSantis' Year as a School Teacher. At a private school 20 years ago, the future Florida governor was a popular history teacher and coach, but some students were taken aback by his comments on the Civil War and abortion. By Francis Robles, reporting from Rome, Georgia. Published November 5, 2022. 20 years ago in the foothills of northwest Georgia, a new history teacher joined the faculty of one of the state's oldest and largest boarding schools. He was a brash young Ivy League graduate, an athlete who made it clear to anyone who was listening that this sojourn at Darlington School was a pit stop on his way to bigger things. Maybe he would even be president someday, he told his students. Amid the revolving door of recent college graduates who taught at one time or another at the independent private school, the teacher, just 23 at the time, was the talk of the 20-year class reunion last month at Darlington for one important reason. He is now governor of Florida. The episodes that former students describe about Governor Ron DeSantis' year at Darlington offer a window into the formative years of one of the most polarizing figures in American politics, a rising Republican politician who is expected to easily win re-election next week and then possibly set his sights on the White House. As a baseball and football coach at the school, Mr. DeSantis was admired and respected by his team. As a teacher, he was remembered by some former students as cocky and arrogant. He once publicly embarrassed a student with a prank, hung out at parties with seniors, and got into debates about the Civil War with students who questioned the focus and sometimes the accuracy of his lessons. The governor who has taken on the woke left over the teaching of history, gender identity, and sexual orientation showed signs back then of being a committed conservative, a young cool teacher whom girls liked and boys envied. He was a total jock. That was his personality, said Gate Minnis, a 2003 graduate who lives in Colorado. He was definitely proud that he graduated Ivy and thought he was very special. But Mr. DeSantis was popular among many students. He was definitely one of the cooler guys, said Tripp Barnes, a student whose mother taught at the school. There were other young teachers who tried to be everybody's friend who didn't have nearly his mystique. He was charismatic and very smart, Mr. Barnes said. People liked him. Mr. DeSantis's office did not respond to requests to discuss his year at Darlington or his students' recollections. The governor does not include his year as a high school teacher in many of his official biographies and does not appear to have spoken publicly at length about his time at the school. Mr. DeSantis taught at Darlington in the 2001-2002 school year after graduating from Yale University and just before attending Harvard Law School. The co-ed independent boarding and day school in Rome, Georgia, founded in 1905, was among the first private schools in the South to admit black students, according to its website. Several students of color who spoke with the Times said they had been recruited with generous scholarships. Boarding students live in one of six dormitories on a lush 500-acre campus northwest of Atlanta in an area now represented in Congress by a conservative firebrand, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. Students visit the non-denominational chapel once a week, tossing their backpacks on the lawn in a manner that suggests no one is worried about theft. Tuition, room, and board for resident students now tops $50,000 a year. With about 750 students from kindergarten to 12th grade, the school students are not just from well-to-do local families, but also from liberal enclaves like New York and California. In Mr. DeSantis' history and government courses, that made for spirited debates. Daniel Pompey remembers Mr. DeSantis, a Florida native and recent Yale grad, being an outsider like her, a New Yorker with a thick accent to match. But Miss Pompey, who was black and was on an academic scholarship, said she felt that Mr. DeSantis treated her worse because of her race. Mr. Ron, Mr. DeSantis was mean to me and hostile toward me, said Miss Pompey, who graduated in 2003. Not aggressively, but passively, because I was black. She recalled Mr. DeSantis teaching Civil War history in a way that sounded to her like an attempt to justify slavery. Like in history class, he was trying to play devil's advocate that the South had good reason to fight that war, to kill other people, over owning people. Black people, she said. He was trying to say it's not okay to own people, but they had property, businesses. Ms. Pompey said she saw parallels between Mr. DeSantis's views as a young educator and his policies as a governor 20 years later. He had a good opportunity to enrich people, to come there from the Northeast and show people in the South that we can blend, she said. It seemed like he didn't want to do that. Miss Minnies, who was white and was in the same history class as Miss Pompey, also remembers debating issues around the Civil War. Mr. DeSantis wasn't so much politically opinionated, she said, but in her view, factually wrong. She remembers him claiming that every city in the South had burned, even though she knew her hometown, Savannah, had not, and she called him out on it. Another student who requested anonymity because he feared repercussions for his job said Mr. DeSantis's takes on the Civil War were the subject of so much talk that students made a satirical video about him at the time for the video yearbook. The video, which was reviewed by the Times, includes a short snippet in which a voice purporting to be Mr. DeSantis is heard saying, "The Civil War was not about slavery. It was about two competing economic systems. One was in the North, while a student dozes in class." A student voiced the role of Mr. DeSantis because students did not have any actual footage of him, according to a student who helped put it together. Abortion was another issue that came up in class at least once, according to Matthew Arney, a former student. Mr. Arney, who was a senior, said students talked among themselves about Mr. DeSantis expressing his strict belief that abortion was wrong. He said it troubled him when his girlfriend, who was in Mr. DeSantis's history class, told him about what Mr. DeSantis had said. He had grown up in California, he said, and disagreed with Mr. DeSantis's stance. "He's pretty much held fast to what he believes in," Mr. Arney said. Ms. Minnis added that he always seemed to have his eye on the future. "He seems like someone who, as a young person, was in it for the long game," she said. Several students described Mr. DeSantis as having an air of superiority. "Mr. DeSantis was kind of a smug guy," Mr. Arney said. "Students were well aware that he had just graduated from Yale," he said. "It was like a, 'I'm kind of better than you,' he said, and we were all just kids." Several students recalled that Mr. DeSantis was a frequent presence at parties with the seniors who lived in town. Most spoke about socializing with him on the condition of anonymity because they feared backlash for speaking publicly about it. As an 18-year-old, I remember thinking, "What are you doing here, dude?" one former student said. Ms. Minnie said that when she was a senior, the fall after Mr. DeSantis left, she found a memo on a teacher's desk reminding the staff that fraternizing with students was inappropriate, even after they graduated. "That's got to be about Mr. DeSantis. That's what I remember everyone saying," she said. Other students remembered at least one other teacher who had socialized with students that year. Last year, Hill Reporter, a blog put out by a Democratic super PAC, published a photograph of Mr. DeSantis taken with several female students from Darlington in 2002, one of whom was holding what appeared to be a bottle of beer. Two former students, both women, remembered him attending at least two parties where alcohol was served, but they said that the parties took place after graduation and that they were not bothered by his presence at the time, although they question it now. "It was his first job out of Yale. He was cute. We didn't really think too much about it," one of the former students said. Two other students remembered a prank involving Mr. DeSantis and a student who had bragged about how much milk he could drink. They said Mr. DeSantis challenged the boy to guzzle as much milk as he could in one sitting. The boy did and threw up as dozens of students watched. "I think about it now. I'm a teacher now in public school," said Adam Moody, who was a freshman on the baseball team and witnessed the incident. "I put myself in that moment, and it's just unthinkable. There's a cruelty to the sense of humor. There's a cruelty to the mentorship." A spokeswoman for Darlington declined to comment in detail about Mr. DeSantis' time there. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The next article comes from NBC News, and it's titled, "Federal Judge Declares Biden's Student Debt Relief Plan Unlawful." A federal appeals court had already blocked immediate implementation of the program. A federal judge in Texas on Thursday ruled that President Joe Biden's plan to cancel hundreds of billions of dollars in student loan debt was unlawful and must be vacated, delivering a victory to conservative opponents of the program. U.S. District Judge Mark Pittman, an appointee of former Republican President Donald Trump in Fort Worth, called the program an unconstitutional exercise of Congress's legislative power as he ruled in favor of two borrowers backed by a conservative advocacy group. The debt relief plan had already been temporarily blocked by the St. Louis-based 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals while it considers a request by six Republican-led states to enjoin it while they appealed the dismissal of their own lawsuit. The judge's ruling came in a lawsuit by two borrowers who were partially or fully ineligible for the loan forgiveness Biden's plan offered. The plaintiffs argued it did not follow proper rulemaking processes and was unlawful. The borrowers were backed by the Job Creators Network Foundation, a conservative advocacy group founded by Bernie Marcus, a co-founder of Home Depot. The U.S. Justice Department promptly moved to appeal the ruling. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said in a statement that administration strongly disagreed with the decision. About 26 million Americans have applied for student loan forgiveness, and the U.S. Department of Education has already approved requests from 16 million. Jean-Pierre said the department would hold on to their information so it can quickly process the relief once we prevail in court. "We will never stop fighting for hard-working Americans most in need, no matter how many roadblocks our opponents and special interests try to put in our way," she said. Biden's plan has been the subject of several lawsuits by conservative state attorneys, general and legal groups, but plaintiffs before Thursday had struggled to convince courts they were harmed by it in such a way that they have standing to sue. The plan, announced in August, calls for forgiving up to $10,000 in student loan debt for borrowers making less than $125,000 per year or $250,000 for married couples. Borrowers who received Pell Grants to benefit lower-income college students will have up to $20,000 of their debt canceled. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office in September calculated the debt forgiveness would eliminate about $430 billion of the $1.6 trillion in outstanding student debt, and that over 40 million people were eligible to benefit. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The next article comes from BBC News, and it's titled, "Teachers in Scotland to go on strike this month." Teachers in Scotland will stage a 24-hour walkout on 24th of November after voting overwhelmingly to strike in a dispute over pay. Members of the EIS union rejected a 5% pay offer, saying they wanted 10%. EIS General Secretary Andrea Bradley said they had become increasingly angry over their treatment by employers and the Scottish government. Deputy First Minister John Swinney previously said there was no more money to fund public sector pay rises. The move comes after Scotland's largest nursing union voted to go on strike for the first time ever in a dispute over pay. The EIS said 96% of its members backed a teacher strike on a 71% turnout. It will hold a further executive meeting on Friday to agree further industrial action. General Secretary Andrea Bradley said, "We hoped not to get to this point, and have given local authorities and the Scottish Government ample time to come up with a fair pay offer. But, with a pay rise for teachers now more than 7 months late, and with the last pay offer having been rejected by teachers almost 3 months ago, the blame for this move to strike action sits squarely with COSLA and the Scottish Government." The next section is called Dithering and Delaying. John Swinney announced £615 million of spending cuts in his emergency budget review earlier this month. It came on top of a £560 million cut to public services in September. The Scottish government said it was committed to supporting a fair pay offer through the Scottish Negotiating Committee for Teachers, the body that negotiates pay and conditions of service. But the EIS accused the government of dithering and delaying while the cost of living crisis continues to erode the value of their pitiful offers to Scotland's teachers. "Teachers do not take strike action lightly," said Andrea Bradley, "but have voted to do so in light of the continuing steep real terms decline in their pay. Politicians who have lauded the invaluable work of teachers throughout the pandemic and during the ongoing period of recovery are now offering teachers a deep real terms pay cut. This will never be acceptable to Scotland's teachers or to the EIS, and that is why Scotland's teachers will be taking strike action 2 weeks from today." And we'll have to cut that article short for time. This final article comes from USA Today, and it's titled, "Newly Elected Florida School Board Member Wants to Revive Corporal Punishment, Cut Rights for LGBTQ Students," by Kate Simini, Naples Daily News, posted November 10, 2022. The morning after being elected, a new school board member in South Florida said he wants to bring back corporal punishment in classrooms and would like to see fewer rights for LGBTQ students. Collier County School Board's newly elected member, Jerry Rutherford, announced the goals Wednesday after beating longtime teacher, administrator, and school board member Jory Westbury for the District 1 seat in Tuesday's election. Rutherford, who protested the LGBTQ festival in Naples and has pushed for Bibles in schools, won the seat with a strong 65.4% of the vote to Westbury's 34.6%. After speaking on myriad issues at school board meetings countless times for more than 35 years, Rutherford told the Naples Daily News in July he decided he didn't want to be on the outside looking in anymore, so he joined the school board race. This was his first time running for any elected position, he said. Rutherford was endorsed by the Collier County Republican Executive Committee, which endorsed all three challengers to the school board. All of them won their races. He's fought to distribute Bibles in schools and to institute prayer at school board meetings. He has also protested Naples' LGBTQ Pride Festival, specifically speaking out against drag shows. A veteran of the Air Force, Rutherford has worked in sales and construction and owned a painting business in the Naples area for more than 20 years. He also served as a substitute teacher in the district for 3 years. Rutherford's stated positions changed dramatically before and after his election. In July, he told the Naples Daily News, part of the USA Today network, his priorities were to ensure proper education that helps everyone succeed, improve safety and mental health for students and teachers, and address budgetary concerns. But Wednesday morning, reached by phone, Rutherford said he has a 5-point agenda he'd like to implement, including mental and physical discipline, or physical punishment of children in Collier's public schools. And we'll also have to cut that article short for time. We've run out of time for this episode of Education Today. Please be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Education Today is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.